It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Lots to cover in 29 minutes. So starting with local and the BIAW.
Yeah, the Building Industry Association of Washington. They are the largest, most powerful, most cash flush, and most conservative major lobby group in the state. And they got popped this week. The Public Disclosure Commission unanimously ruled that they were in egregious violation of campaign finance law on a couple of different fronts. They, and also the Master Builders Association of Washington and an allied trade group, were both in violation of campaign finance law, basically for hiding their bankrolling of several different front groups and for illegally bundling the dues of their members and shuttling them off into campaign donations without the permission of their members. This is particularly relevant because the BIAW is pushing very, very hard to elect Dino Rossi this year and has been behind a number of stealth campaigns that have not had the what's called the little authority tag, that is the little thing at the bottom of any advertisement saying this advertisement paid for by People United for Dino Rossi or whatever the name of it's going to be for each candidate. They haven't identified who's been sponsoring these various ads, one of which in particular got a lot of attention and notoriety being a billboard campaign in eastern Washington saying, "Don't let Seattle steal the next governor's race, Dino Rossi for governor." And Dino Rossi, of course, the Rossi campaign said, "Oh, we didn't have anything to do with that. We have no idea who was behind that." And, of course, their largest contributor and largest financial backer was behind it, but not identifying that they were. So this, although a lot of the coverage hasn't really connected the dots in terms of how it's relevant to the Dino Rossi campaign, a lot of attention is getting paid for this, to the point where Attorney General for the state, Rob McKenna, who has also been a big beneficiary of BIAW funds over his political career, he of course the highest ranking Republican statewide office holder, the ruling was such a slam dunk that the BIAW is in violation of the law that McKenna himself was forced to, or his office was forced to go ahead and file suit this week against the BIAW. Would not surprise me if the AG's office very quietly decided to settle that out of court down the road in exchange for a firm slap on the wrist and a wagging finger admonishing them never, ever do that again. But that's something to keep an eye on because McKenna has been very much in the back pocket of BIAW his entire career. And, of course, one of the other aspects of this is that it all happens after the fact. So would not also be surprising to see more stealth campaigns by the BIAW and their allies in the run-up for the governor's race this fall. And then sometime along about the middle of next year, we'll get a finding from the PDC that there were yet more violations of state campaign finance law as a result of this. That being said, it is confirmation that there's a lot of dirty tricks going on in the governor's race this year and to watch out for them.
All right. Moving from that to this week's economic news.
Yeah, the economy's been the big headliner all this week and for much of last week as well. And I just want to talk, last week we talked a little bit about bailouts. This week I want to talk about just the crisis itself. I've been getting a lot of questions from people. The first question, of course, is how did it all start? Back in 1999, the Congress repealed the Depression-era law, the Glass-Steagall Act, and that repeal allowed financial companies to own a financial company could own a commercial bank, an investment bank, mortgage brokerages, a consumer lending unit, et cetera, and they could do that all under one roof. So, and it removed a whole bunch of controls, and this coincided with the invention of a lot of derivatives and unusual securities. So before 1999, in essence, you had commercial banks, which were separate from investment banks, which were separate from brokerage firms, which were separate from insurance companies, et cetera. But then after 1999, anyone could own any of these units, and they could put them all together in one company. And so anyone basically could issue risky mortgages, and pretty much just about everybody who could make mortgages did that. And then anybody who didn't issue mortgage loans, they could go out and they could buy what's called a CDO, or a mortgage-backed security. And so they could invest in risky mortgages. So now the question becomes, how could these mortgage-backed securities have led to this whole mess that we're in, that we've seen happen this week, including the many analysts are saying, the almost complete collapse of the U.S. financial markets? Well, you have to just look very closely at the nature of mortgage-backed securities. The whole crisis is based on a very, very simple problem, and this is key. Banks made risky loans. Banks that owned brokerage firms, that owned these mortgage lending units, made these risky loans. Then they called these loans assets, and they turned them around and used them as collateral to borrow more money to make more risky loans, and on and on and on into infinity. So that's the nature of the problem. Basically, banks making risky loans, calling those loans assets, using those assets as collateral to borrow more money, using that borrowed money to make more risky loans, turning those risky loans again into assets to borrow more money, and on and on and on and on. And as you might expect, all these layers of debt means that it's very, very difficult to know how much is out there. But it's clear that it was done in such volumes that it absolutely dwarfed the amount of actual cash on hand that any of these banks had. And it even dwarfed their other assets. So in the case of some banks, it dwarfed the value of their commercial banks. Commercial banks being the bank that you go to on the street corner where you deposit your money and you have your cash and savings, etc. So these layers and layers and layers of debt are enormous. Back in August 2007, well, actually before then, subprime loans, these risky loans that were made, these subprime loans started to go bad sometime around 2006, but it didn't really hit the market in such volumes until about August 2007. That's when the big banking companies had to take their first big multi-billion dollar write-down.
Can I ask a question about the volume of the debts?
Yeah.
How can the volume of the debts be higher than the combined value of the original risky mortgages that were sold? How does that multiply?
That's not what I said. That's not what I said. What I said is that banks made some initial risky mortgages.
Yes.
And they took those risky mortgages and they called them assets. They bundled them together and made mortgage-backed securities, which they called assets. Then they used those assets as collateral to borrow more money to make more risky loans, which they then bundled together as mortgage-backed securities and called them assets, used those assets as collateral to borrow more money to make more risky loans, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got layers and layers and layers of bad loans that were at one point determined to be assets that were used as collateral to make more loans. So you see how it layers up?
Okay, so if I'm gonna come back to this later when we talk about where do we go from here.
Uh-huh.
But so the value of the liquidity crisis is out there is still basically the value of all the bad loans that are out there.
Yes, yes, and the truth is nobody knows how much bad debt is out there. That's very key to the crisis is, you know, numbers get thrown around like this government bailout. People say, oh, it's going to be a minimum $500 billion, maybe up to a trillion. The truth is they don't know. $500 billion is a number pulled out of a hat. Basically what they did is they said, well, the IMF said that the whole crisis will be about $1 trillion. The Fed and the Treasury have already committed about $500 to $600 billion to the crisis. So let's see, $1 trillion minus $500 billion is $500 billion. That's how they came up with that number. Essentially, they're just scratching their heads and pulling a number out of the hat. The truth is, the government bailout could be way more than $1 trillion. It could be less than $500 billion. We don't know. We have no clue. And that's what's been key to the problems in the market, because when you ask the question, why now? Why didn't everything collapse back in August 2007 when the first write-downs were taken? Why is it happening right now? Why didn't it happen sooner? You know, if you ask that question, it's an obvious question. You get the answer of first, that 1 year has gone by since the crisis first hit, and in spite of all the happy talk that's happened over that year, the write-downs have not ceased. Companies are still reporting big write-downs, which means that it's clear nobody knows, not even the heads of these companies that made all of these risky loans. So that's what the problem is. A year has gone by. It's a psychological date, really, for the market and for investors and for these companies. It's a psychological date. 1 year has gone by. Things are no better. In fact, they're getting worse. And so now we're starting to see people panic and say, I got to get my money out. Well,
can I ask another question?
Sure,
on the why now?
Sure.
I want to ask the other end of it. Why, when it's so obviously in the Bush administration's interest to try and delay this crisis for another, oh, say, 7 weeks, mm-hmm. Why couldn't they have taken some sort of a fundamental step that would have put it off until after the election?
The government can't control the markets, essentially. And the Bush administration is hobbled by its extreme right-wing ideology that you leave the markets to themselves and government should never intervene if you can possibly help it in the markets, because the markets will right themselves. And you could see that in the Fed's actions in the past few months, when Bear Stearns in March was in trouble and was at the risk of failing. Everybody said, you gotta bail him out, because if Bear Stearns goes, our whole financial markets go. And the Treasury and the Fed stepped in and they bailed him out. Well, when Lehman Brothers came up, and this is, you know, this week, this is leading into these events of this week, when Lehman Brothers was on the verge of failing, they, about a week ago, they had a good offer for a buyout from an investment company, from a couple of investment firms, wanted to buy them and said, we're going to make you this offer. You're not going to like the price that we're going to give you, but we will buy you out and you can avoid a bankruptcy. And Lehman Brothers looked at the terms of the offer and they said, no, we'll take a pass on that because, you know, the Fed bailed out Bear Stearns and we think they'll bail out us. So they went to the Fed and the Fed said, and you have to understand that the Fed and the Treasury Secretary, but most particularly the Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, have been sitting in these meetings at the White House where you've got these right-wingers, George Bush and Dick Cheney, with their right-wing ideology that says you never interfere with markets. And they're getting pressure from the president to not do bailouts, because that's, you know, that's left-wing. That's too left-wing for them. They want you to leave the markets alone, let these companies fail, make people take the pain, right? So here's, and yet the Treasury Secretary and the Fed both realize that if you let these companies fail, it's going to be chaos. And they understand that these companies are so big now because of all the deregulation. These companies have gotten so big that if one of them fails, it's going to take down markets all over the world, and that's going to have political fallout. This is something that George Bush and Dick Cheney don't understand, but something that Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke at the Fed, they understand this. Well, so Paulson's getting pressure from the president not to do bailout, and so Lehman comes up, the fourth largest investment bank, not the largest, which was Bear Stearns, the fourth largest. It comes up, wants a handout, and Henry Paulson has to say no. So he said no, and Lehman, taken completely by surprise, you know, and saw their stock drop precipitously, and they had to declare bankruptcy. Basically, the Fed let them fail. The Fed and the Treasury let them fail.
And it was too late to go back on that previous deal that had been offered them?
Yeah, it was too late, because once the Fed says, no, we can't give you a loan, then other companies go, oh, my God, maybe they're in worse trouble than we thought. We don't want to buy them now.
Well, plus the value of their stock dropped precipitously.
Yeah, and so they're really not worth what they were before. It was a good deal for those investment firms to make the offer when they did, when Lehman Brothers was worth more. But when the stock drops precipitously and they're worth less, that deal's off the table completely. So Lehman Brothers failed. It's the largest bankruptcy in history, $639 billion in assets. And you might ask, how can a company with $639 billion in assets go bankrupt? Well, it's, as Job said, a liquidity crisis. They can't sell those assets And there's a question of how much of those $639 billion in assets are really worth that much at this point.
And it's a measure of how big the news has been this week that the largest bankruptcy in the history of the country is maybe the third or fourth biggest financial story of the week.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And at the same time, Merrill Lynch was smart enough to take the deal that Bank of America offered them and not hold out for a Fed rescue, I think because they saw what was happening to Lehman Brothers and they read the political currents correctly and decided, well, we will sell ourselves to Bank of America for 50 cents on the dollar, which is what they did. And then, of course, AIG hit the news, massive insurance company, which is not just an insurance company. They do all kinds of things, including they have a business where they lease planes from the Boeing company, or they buy planes from the Boeing company to lease out to their customers. So they're involved, as I said, because Glass-Steagall was repealed in 1999. Insurance companies can do all kinds of different things, and finance companies can do all kinds of different things now. But you might ask the question, how could an insurance company get sucked so deeply into this? And how in the heck they didn't have mortgage-backed securities. What is the problem? Well, the problem is AIG sold huge amounts of a credit derivative. Now, the credit derivative is called a credit default swap. What it is basically is it's an insurance policy sold to companies that bought mortgage-backed securities. Say you're an investment bank like Goldman Sachs, for example. You bought a lot of mortgage-backed securities, and you looked at those and you said, we got to manage this risk somehow. What happens if our mortgage-backed securities lose value? We need to buy something that will hedge our bets, something that will pay us off if these drop in value. So they bought this product from AIG called a credit default swap, which is an insurance policy that will pay them if their mortgage-backed securities will pay, you know, Goldman Sachs and any other company that bought them, will pay them money if their mortgage-backed securities fall in value. Well, and what has happened over the past year, the market in mortgage-backed securities has plummeted, and most of them are not worth anything. And so now people are lining up to try to get money out of AIG for their losses, and AIG sold billions, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of these things, and they don't have the cash to back them up and make the payments on them. So that's why AIG is in trouble. And it just goes to the question of how could companies write these risky derivatives and be able to sell them and not be required to have a minimum amount of cash on hand to cover losses in case there are calls on these derivatives. It's because the markets are deregulated. There's no regulation to force that. So you might ask, why did the government bail out AIG when they didn't bail out Lehman Brothers? The answer to that is these derivatives were sold not just to Goldman Sachs, but to banks all over the world and to foreign governments, to institutional investors. That pretty much any institutional investor that bought mortgage-backed securities bought a certain number of credit default swaps. And so it's an enormous problem. It's not just a U.S. financial problem, it's a global economic problem, and in fact it could become a national security issue if you let a company like AIG fail. So then the other question is, what is the bailout deal and what will taxpayers get from it? Well, what the Fed did this week is the Federal Reserve Bank loaned $85 billion to AIG cash, $85 billion cash to AIG at a usurious rate. I mean, the interest rate they're going to get on this loan is somewhere between like 12 to 15% interest. So the Fed's making out on this if AIG can ever pay them back. In turn, the Treasury, that's the U.S. government, will become the majority shareholder in AIG. So between the two of them, the U.S. government and the Fed, which is a private bank, will then control AIG's business and make all the major decisions. What they're going to do then is sell the valuable assets that AIG owns, the commercial insurance portion, the plane leasing portion, et cetera, in order to pay the company's debts to their creditors, including pay the Fed back on their $85 billion loan. And, of course, all the crap, all the stuff that's worthless, will stay on the books. In other words, the U.S. government, at the end of the day, once all the assets are sold, the taxpayers will own all the junk securities. And that means, of course, even though analysts and and people trying to sell the deal to the public say, oh, the U.S. government and the taxpayers could get some money back if the markets recover and these things have any value. The truth is these things are never going to really have any value. And U.S. taxpayers will be on the hook to pay the difference between how much debt AIG owes to its creditors and how much money is actually recovered once all the assets are sold. There's going to be a big gap there, and taxpayers are going to be pouring money into that hole for a while. So you might ask, why did the government get in on the deal to become the majority shareholder? The answer to that is that nobody else wanted to do it. No other bank would step in and take over AIG because, of course, nobody wants that crap on their books. And the government did it to calm the markets, essentially, by not letting AIG collapse and by ensuring that its creditors would get paid, these international banks and foreign governments and everybody who owns their debt, that was supposed to calm the markets. And then, of course, there's the bigger bailout, where the Fed and Treasury are taking a plan to Congress in order to bail out the rest of the financial industry. That includes the Treasury setting up a fund to buy back mortgage-backed securities from anybody and everybody who has this junk on their books. But most particularly, at this point, they're saying only U.S. companies, which is going to make global banking firms and foreign governments pretty ticked off, I think. But as I said, the amount of money that analysts are saying this is going to cost is about $500 billion. The truth is they don't know. They have not got a clue. And it could be much, much bigger bailout than anybody expects.
So here's why I was asking the other question earlier about mm-hmm. about the value of the loans. Wouldn't it, I mean, aside from the obvious ideology of we help the very wealthy but not everybody else, wouldn't it solve the liquidity crisis to simply, rather than bailing out the banks, bailing out the mortgage holders?
Yeah, but
and
actually,
have them pay the banks for their actual debt so that they don't get foreclosed on their homes?
There's two ways to go about a bailout. One is to pour money in the top to save the rich guys, which is what the Bush administration's doing now. And the other is to put money in at the bottom and save the people who are losing their homes. Well, there was a one-year time frame in which the Bush administration could have and Congress could have put together a plan to do that injecting money in at the bottom to save homeowners, and that would have avoided all of this. But that time has passed. When the markets start moving, and they move very, very fast, and companies start losing the value of their stock and being unable to pay their creditors, then the only way you can bail them out really is by injecting money at the top. And because no action was done in the past year, when people kept saying, and including me, kept saying, you gotta come up with a bailout to help homeowners. Something has to be done, or it's gonna get worse. Here it is. Nobody at the federal level did anything, and now it's worse.
All right. Did you want to touch on the solutions from Mr. Obama and Mr. McCain?
Do we have time?
Not a lot. We got 4 minutes.
Okay, well, I'll go very quickly. McCain's done multiple U-turns. I suppose you could call them flip-flops. First, he said we should have no bailouts. And then, of course, this week he said, oh, yeah, bailing out AIG is a good idea. You know, his record has been against any kind of regulation of the finance industry. But then this week he's been on the pro-regulation bandwagon. And he's not been able to address
any. He was
a
co-sponsor of that 1999 bill, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, his main advisor, Senator Phil Graham, wrote the legislation to deregulate the financial industry so that all this could come about. So, I mean, the best McCain could come up with is let's appoint a commission to study the problem, which I think points directly to the problem with him is that he doesn't understand the problem. Therefore, he wants a study done. Obama, on the other hand, back in March when Bear Stearns collapsed, he came up with specific plan. He said the Fed should be able to regulate any company that borrows money from it. Boom, right there, specific plan. Regulators should set standards for how much cash on hand banks must have. There must be some kind of liquidity standard, not just capitalization standard. And that proves he understands the problem is writing risky loans and calling things assets when they're not assets and not having enough cash on hand. And then he said, third, government should create an oversight body that can identify risky types of investments before they become a systemic problem, which means he understands derivatives. And somebody who understands these things is the guy you want to go for. It doesn't necessarily mean that Obama will do a better job than McCain. He might do exactly the same thing McCain would do if McCain was in office. But it just means you're talking about somebody who knows the problem instead of being stumbling around in the dark, like the Bush administration has been.
All right.
But do we really need to talk about that? Can't we talk about Moose Drove or something?
All right. We got about 2 minutes left, Mr. Parrish, for Pakistan and Vents.
Let's just noting parenthetically, since we've talked about this in the past and we have several events, that the Pakistan did say this week, and not only the general, but also now the president has come out and said that if the United States puts soldiers into Pakistan again, Pakistan will have orders to shoot them. So you can expect some pilotless drones being used to kill people in Pakistan in the future rather than the piloted planes.
Okay.
And the ground troops.
All right. And quickly, events.
Several events coming up this week. Today, there's a nationwide thing going on in the Seattle area as well called A Million Doors for Peace. People will be knocking on doors, getting them to sign petitions to try and end the war in Iraq. So if somebody knocks on your door, please do sign. Also, for people over this way, since the KEXP signal does get over in this direction, and of course, so does the internet, on the peninsula today in Port Angeles, a Stop the Checkpoints march and rally against immigration checkpoints being set up recently on the Olympic Peninsula. That'll be at 1 o'clock in Port Angeles at First and Oak. Wednesday, Sarah Palin was going to be in town, and it was just announced yesterday that she can't leave John McCain's side. I mean, no, she had a scheduling conflict. This was to be for a fundraiser in Hunts Point. So Cindy McCain is going to be in town instead. Because of this, from 4 to 7 o'clock on Wednesday, there was going to be an anti-Palin rally downtown called Honesty is the Best Policy. No word yet from organizers on whether that rally is still going to be happening. I suspect it will be. Maybe since Cindy McCain stole John McCain from his then crippled wife, we could have Fidelity is the Best Policy. And then on September 28th, a week from tomorrow, Eat the State will be having its anniversary party and fundraiser at Not a Number of Books in Wallingford. Jim Page and other musicians will be there to play. We'll have 10% off of store merchandise, and we'll have including Eat the State t-shirts, I would imagine. And we'll just have a party. So please come on by. Help us out. We're in the middle of a fundraising campaign that will be a week from tomorrow, Sunday the 28th, 7 o'clock at Not a Number of Books on North 45th in Wallingford. We'll have the address for you next week. Meantime, we are in the middle of a fundraising drive, so you can help out Eat the State. We do owe our printer a great deal of money, so hit that PayPal button on www.eatthestate.org or send your donations to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. If you value independent media and independent news and opinions like you hear in this program. We also always look for volunteers, people who can help out with the distribution, writers, proofreaders, all that kind of good thing. So if you want to help out with that, our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947 or email us at info@eatthestate.org.